Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, 2000. In the Creekside Room this morning, we have Rinda West. Today's session titled, Reflecting on Nature, Blessings, Litanies, and Chants. Let's listen in.
And the session is on meditations on nature, blessings, chants, and litanies. All the poems, except one, that I've chosen today are from this book, called Earth Prayers, which is very lovely. It has 365 prayers.
Is that listed on here?
It isn't, no. I'll be happy to share the book with you.
The title of this one is not here either.
Well, some of these don't have titles. Some of them don't.
Oh, I meant the title of the course.
Oh, the title of the course. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I typed the poems before I left home and duplicated them so that I wouldn't have to order one book since nothing's all in one book. Tell you a little bit about myself. I teach at Oakton, which is a community college outside Chicago. And for 10 years, I've been teaching with a biologist. So he teaches environmental science, and I teach literature about nature. My PhD was in modern drama, so it's pretty unrelated. This is something that I've grown into. And I've been doing volunteer work with the Nature Conservancy in natural areas restoration in the Chicago area.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome. Choose a chair that's got some poems on it, why don't you? And my approach to it is that approaching nature is a way of approaching God. That we see God in creation, we see God in the natural world. And I've selected for today a variety of poems from several different traditions that will give you an idea of how different people have approached the sort of spiritual relationship with nature. I'd be interested to hear who you are, since we're a small group, if we could just go around and let everybody say her name and maybe where she's from and why she chose to come to this workshop. I just think it's friendlier.
I'm Judy from Seattle.
Thanks.
What's a teacher?
Good. Thanks.
Yeah, my name is Shari Engstrom. I'm from Seattle. I've always felt comfort in nature. And that it speaks to us sometimes when nothing else can. Yeah.
Thanks.
We have that book at home, The Earth Poems.
The Earth Poems. It's a nice book, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks.
I'm Carolyn Brunel, and I'm from Minneapolis. And I'm always in awe of people who can write. And I think poetry is such a focus that helps me to see things in new ways. I'm so appreciative. I know primarily poetry through music, so when I see it, it just helps me image more.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think of poetry as a focus also, a focus for meditation often. And as a teacher, students often say to me, well, what's the meaning of the poem? And I frustrate them because I tell them that the meaning of the poem is in the relationship between you and the poem. And it doesn't have a meaning until it has a reader. It doesn't have a meaning until someone unpacks it and makes it her own. So although it's like a relationship with a person, you can't make the relationship be just what you want it to be, and the other person can't make the relationship be just what he or she wants it to be. It's a mutual kind of thing. So we can't read this poem and say, well, it's about Buicks, because it's clearly not about Buicks. But neither can the poet or the writer say, well, this is the only thing it means, because if you have different associations with it, then that's what you'll take with it. Two of the pieces we're going to read today, the first and the third, are one is a blessing litany and one is a chant, and they're both from the Native American tradition. And the other two are poems from the Christian tradition.
And there's a difference between a litany and a poem in that a litany or a chant is something that, if it has one author, the author isn't important. It doesn't matter who wrote it. What matters is how it's used in community. Whereas with a poem, it's a little bit different, because with a poem, you've got a writer who's constructed something, composed something that reflects a kind of complex take on things. So I think that the contrast between the two kinds of writing is interesting. Since I'm familiar with these pieces and you're not, I'm going to read them aloud to you first. And then I always find that you can't get a poem on one reading, so I'll give you a little bit of time to go back and look through it yourself before we get into talking about them. The first one is a Chinook blessing litany, and I chose it because it's from this part of the world. And as I read it and as you think about it, I think the first question I'd like you to think about is, how does this poem represent these people's relationship with nature? And how might that be familiar to you, and how might it be different from your own relationship with nature? So this is the litany. We call upon the earth, our planet home, with its beautiful depths and soaring heights, its vitality and abundance of life, and together we ask that it teach us and show us the way. We call upon the mountains, the Cascades and the Olympics, the high green valleys and meadows filled with wildflowers, the snows that never melt, the summits of intense silence, and we ask that they teach us and show us the way. We call upon the waters that rim the earth, horizon to horizon, that flow in our rivers and streams, that fall upon our gardens and fields, and we ask that they teach us and show us the way. We call upon the land which grows our food, the nurturing soil, the fertile fields, the abundant gardens and orchards, and we ask that they teach us and show us the way. We call upon the forests, the great trees reaching strongly to the sky with earth in their roots and the heavens in their branches, the fir and the pine and the cedar, and we ask them to teach us and show us the way. We call upon the creatures of the fields and forests and the seas, our brothers and sisters, the wolves and deer, the eagle and dove, the great whales and the dolphin, the beautiful orca and salmon who share our Northwest home, and we ask them to teach us and show us the way. We call upon all those who have lived on this earth, our ancestors and our friends who dreamed the best for future generations, and upon whose lives our lives are built, and with thanksgiving we call upon them to teach us and show us the way. And lastly, we call upon all that we hold most sacred, the presence and power of the great spirit of love and truth which flows through all the universe, to be with us, to teach us, and show us the way.
Is that who, I didn't hear it, dream the best for future generations?
Yes, I have two typos in here. No, I beg your pardon for them. The best for future generations and summits of intense silence, not summits in intense silence. I don't know, do you want to take another minute or two to be with the poem? Are there parts of it that speak to you more than others? Parts of it that you respond to?
I was wondering if there was a reason for it. It seems to me that they start out with the whole planet, and then the mountains, and then it comes to the people who are living in on the planet. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if this was taken in that sequence.
I expect it was, yes. That's a very nice observation, that it moves from the largest down to the human, and then back out to the spirit.
And coming from Seattle in that area, we know, well, I think all Native Americans have such an affinity with nature. It's so important to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you certainly get that sense of affinity in this, don't you?
Yes.
What else did people respond to or relate to?
Another thing that I was impressed of is they're built, they're wanting to be taught.
Teachers.
I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To show the way, because I think so many of the rest of us are not that eager to be taught.
Yes, I guess that gives a sense of humility in relation to nature, doesn't it? That there is much that we learn from the planet, mm-hmm. from the trees.
I think it's for people who live in the city, it's very easy to take so much for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always in awe of the power of things like fire and water.
Mm-hmm.
That I really am something that's just, that is part of nature, and that all of this around here goes on without my making it happen, or any of us making it happen. And it helps me to think about, this helps me to think that this is so much bigger than who we are.
I respond to that very much. I think that there's almost a pun in the expression, taking it for granted, because the word granted sounds so much like the word granite. And when we're in our normal lives, our away from Holden lives, and we live in rectangles, you know, we live in squares, and everything's constructed, and the power comes to us through pipes and through wires and across airwaves, and everything's been created by humans, and we lose the perspective, the much larger perspective of the planet that we live in and the creation that makes all of this possible. And so we do feel as though we have power. We feel as though we have dominion over things. And for me, one of the blessings, the great blessings of Holden is waking up every morning and seeing those gigantic mountains towering over me. And those of you who live in the West, of course, have this more than those of us who live in the Midwest, but it puts you in perspective. It puts you in relation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very fortunate in that I'm long-term staff. Mm-hmm. I've been here almost a year, and I'm going to stay at least one more year. And the verse that spoke to me particularly was the one we call upon the forests and the great trees, because they are so magnificent here, and the wind in them, mm-hmm. sometimes, and the sound and the movement.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that...
As you read that stanza, do you feel related to those trees?
No. I'm an observer of them.
You are. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Any of you?
Does anybody feel that way? I mean, you said earlier that Native American people, and I only know this by what I've read or understood about somebody else to say, and I feel like Native American people have much more feeling of unity with nature, mm-hmm. than certainly I do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really feel like I have any. I feel, mm-hmm. like it's nature and me. Mm-hmm. I would love to understand how that comes about.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is in the Native American tradition to believe that there is spirit not only in humans and not only in animals, but also in trees and rocks and water and air, that everything partakes of spirit, everything is alive. And we have science, and our science makes divisions between the biotic and the abiotic, between life and that which is not life. And that's something that they didn't. So for them, mm-hmm. A rock is a living being. It's a presence. It's something to be honored.
Mm-hmm.
A waterfall is a living being. When I read the stanza, the reason I ask the question is because the great trees reaching strongly to the sky with earth in their roots and the heavens in their branches, mm-hmm. is an image that I would love to have of myself. I don't know that I do exactly, but I think that the fact that we are vertical animals, that our feet are on the earth, and our heads are in the sky in some sense or other, gives me an affinity with trees, if not a sense of relationship, at least, you know, that sense. And I love when I'm here, I love feeling the earth beneath my feet and the sense that there's an energy flow that goes all the way back, up and back. I love the notion that trees take their water from the earth and pump it. How do they do that? All the way up to the branches where they make the food and then pipe the food back down and, you know, do these great cycles.
How do flowers break through snow?
Yes.
And every November, December, it looks like nothing will ever grow again.
Mm-hmm.
And then flowers come up through the snow.
Yeah.
I'm always so impressed with all the concrete, and if there's a little crack, here grass comes up.
Yes.
I just really marvel at that.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Life clings to,
you know, all concrete here, swear that we're in the world. And yet they come.
Getting back to the trees, I'm more like you. I think I really kind of identify with them.
Mm-hmm.
And like to think of God coming up through the ground and giving me strength like the trees. So being here at Holden and seeing those,
mm-hmm.
all the trees is a strength. And the other verse that spoke to me is the one about the great whales and the dolphin, mm-hmm. and the beautiful orca, because we not live on our boat and haven't had a chance to take a trip this summer, but last summer we're able to observe all of these things and really enjoy them for several weeks, the power of the eagle and the seeing the great whales and dolphins that just dance by our boat and just give you a... You just wish you could be more like them, more free. And
mm-hmm.
So it was wonderful and renewing, and I think nature usually does that for me. That's why I like being here.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very typical of our Northwest.
Yeah, this would be a wonderful one to use at our church sometime, mm-hmm. when we have a nature
mm-hmm.
service.
Yes.
It's got all the...
It does,
and
it honors.
The fact that the earth does teach us.
Mm-hmm. And the poem is an honoring. I think I see it as a poem of praise and thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
That by naming, it brings into the conversation all of the elements of nature, including our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
The wolves and deer. You know, we may be more inclined to think of Bambi as related to us than the wolf, but both predator and prey, both wolf and deer, are our siblings. And I love the idea that we share the planet with other forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think we do get, living in cities, we get so self-centered, so human-centered, that it's important for us to remember that there are others.
I think when you were talking about the tree,
mm-hmm.
and I felt the same way. I didn't feel like I related to a tree. But sometimes when someone else says how, like you said, mm-hmm. how you related to the wolf, it's just taking somebody else saying something like that that helps me to go, oh, right. It's just a matter of thinking in a different way that I haven't thought about before. We go to Florida and live for a little tiny time, and I see the dolphins down there, and I do feel an affinity. I talk to them. I wish they would talk back to me or come up to me, you know. And I, so it's just a different kind of awareness.
Well, that reminds me of something that I think is really important in terms of poetry, and that is that poetry is so much richer in community than it is when you just read it on your own, because you get everyone's associations with it. And yes, when you hear someone else's association, it enriches your own, enriches and changes your own.
Sometimes.
Exactly, right.
And I like that in Wesley, and I don't think that Wesley's necessarily, but I think we call upon all that we hold most sacred, because all of this is sacred to them. That's right. The present and power of the great spirit of love and truth, which flows throughout the universe. Right. I think that's implied in every aspect here.
It is implied in every aspect, and that's a very nice observation, that the great spirit is in everything, and then explicitly gets named as the final participant in the litany. How did you relate to the stanza where they call upon those who've lived on this earth, our ancestors and our friends who dreamed the best for future generations, and upon whose lives our lives are built?
I liked it. I thought it seemed like something that we have services at church. I forget which Sunday it is. But anyway, we're
All Saints Day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. All Saints Day. But this just reminds me of that. And I think we're sort of still in touch with them.
But I think some cultures have feel more closely than
right.
the Caucasians do.
The Native Americans do.
I think the Asians also have
Chinese
that feeling.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that we don't. There's something lacking there, I think, for us.
Dead and gone.
Yeah. And it doesn't take long to forget them.
It doesn't, and yet it's wrong to, somehow. I mean, I know that's a very strong statement, but I think that it's psychologically wrong and spiritually wrong now that we are living the lives our ancestors dreamed. We're part of their story. And we do forget them too easily in our culture, I think. And of all the pieces in this litany, that's the one, oddly enough, that to me seems the most culturally unfamiliar, is the attention to those who went before. And yet when we think in our own lives how much we want our children to remember us, how we want to leave a legacy, we want to have made some impact on the future, and then you look back in the other direction and you see how quick we are to forget. Sometimes.
I was thinking about education, in that I don't think our nation's schools teach our own history well enough anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't know from what we came from as a country, I think we're headed towards making the same mistakes over again, and it's borne out when you hear about the kids in school who don't know anything about their government or our history. Or I think it's important that we know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm guilty of that. I would pass a very clear hand and text about it, but I feel that it's important. I have a sense that it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about my own history, my own family history, and myself.
So. One of the differences between traditional cultures and Christian culture is in the sense of time. And when I say traditional cultures, I mean agricultural or hunter-gatherer cultures, such as the Native American or the traditional African. This is not the case with the Asian cultures, because they're much more developed. But the traditional cultures tend to have a cyclical sense of time, that time moves in circles rather than in a line, in an arrow kind of way. And the circles are often inscribed by the seasons of the year and by planting, mm-hmm. by agricultural events, because that's the way the people lived. So there would be springtime rituals, and when the people performed the rituals that go along with the points in the cycle, the belief is that they are recreating the original events that are the events on which the culture is founded and on which the culture's practices are founded. So when they sow the seed, they sow the seed in the manner of the ancestors, and they sow the seed in that way, in the sort of ritually prescribed way that replicates the original events and puts them, therefore, in their belief system, closer to the truth, closer to reality.
Closer to the earth.
Closer to the earth, closer to the ancestors, closer to the way it's supposed to be. There's a sense that we need to return to the patterns that govern the cycle of time in traditional cultures. So each of the seasons here, as you move through it, will have its ritual that returns you to what there's a famous anthropologist called, this pen doesn't work very well, Mircea Eliade. Eliade wrote a lot about these cyclical time cycle. And he said that in performing the ritual act, you reenact the original. Really the closest thing we have to that is the Eucharist. And the Roman Catholics do it more literally because of the transubstantiation, so that they believe that the bread and the wine actually are not symbolically, but really the body and blood of Christ. And we have certainly the liturgical year, but I think that as a culture, we're much more along an arrow, we're much more along a continuum, whereas traditional people are much more along a cycle. One of the things that does is it emphasizes the life of the community rather than the life of the individual, because the life of the community is the life of renewal, is the life of the cycle. The distinction then is between the circle and the arrow. And Judeo-Christian tradition teaches us that everything is moving toward the fulfillment of God's will. And that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated, that events are not necessarily repeated, that events are unique, whereas in traditional cultures, the notion is that events are repeated and that it's in the repetition that they get the reality. Whereas in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's the uniqueness of events, a unique incarnation. There are foreshadowings, of course, but it's the uniqueness of events that gives them their reality. This really creates a very different psychology, I think. I think that we're more focused on the individual, whereas for traditional cultures, the focus was more on the community, and the individual was more inclined to see it as her job to put herself in harmony with others, whereas we are more inclined culturally to see it as our job to fulfill ourselves, to fulfill our individuality. So it's just a different kind of relationship. Let's look at the second poem. We're not going to make it through four, but that's okay.
This is the first one from the earth.
That's right.
It sounded familiar. I bet we have used it in the church. And then we say, teach us and show us the way. Mm-hmm. That's probably why it sounded so, and it's so perfect for the Northwest.
It is perfect for you all.
Can I just ask you one quick question about this? When it was originally written, mm-hmm. is it written in a Native American language, and how is it translated?
That's a very good question, and I don't have an exact answer for it. My guess would be that this is a poem or a litany that was written after white people had come here, and because of the names of things, the Cascades and the Olympics, mm-hmm. are not the names that the Native people would have given. Mm-hmm. those mountains. So my guess is that this is a relatively recent composition. So that the poem itself is more of a blend of traditional and Western.
They had a different name for the Cascade Zone, did they?
I'm sure they had different names for them.
So they're just translating.
It could be a translation from a native language, but my guess would be that it's not. But that's just a guess. The next is by Teilhard de Chardin, whom you're probably familiar with. Teilhard, of course, was a Jesuit. His dates are 1881 to 1955. And he was trained, had a long training, was ordained, and then went and trained himself as a paleontologist and spent most of his life practicing science and wrote about science. His religious writings were not released until after his death because the church wouldn't give him permission to release his religious writings. His theology was that the universe is an evolutionary process moving towards systems of ever greater complexity and ever higher levels of consciousness, and toward a fulfillment in which all things will be gathered up in God. He saw matter as sacramental and the universe as a process of what he called Christification. That the whole evolutionary process, and again, you can see the stark difference between the cycle and the arrow, where in Teilhard's idea, everything is moving toward consciousness, toward Christification. So this is a very different poem.
And what was his the years of his life?
Oh, 1881 to 1955. Blessed be you, harsh matter, barren soil, stubborn rock. You who yield only to force, you who cause us to work if we would eat. Blessed be you, perilous matter, violent sea, untamable passion. You who, unless we fetter you, will devour us. Blessed be you, mighty matter, irresistible march of evolution, reality ever newborn. You who by constantly shattering our mental categories force us to go ever further and further in our pursuit of the truth. Blessed be you, universal matter, immeasurable time, boundless ether, triple abyss of stars and atoms and generations. You who by overflowing and dissolving our narrow standards or measurements reveal to us the dimensions of God. Blessed be you, impenetrable matter, you who interposed between our minds and the world of essences, cause us to languish with the desire to pierce through the seamless veil of phenomena. Blessed be you, mortal matter, you who one day will undergo the process of dissolution within us and will thereby take us forcibly into the very heart of that which exists. You who batter us and then dress our wounds, you who resist and yield to us, you who wreck and build, you who shackle and liberate, sorry for the typo, the sap of our souls, the hand of God, the flesh of Christ, it is you, matter, that I bless. So I have two typos in here. It's mortal matter, not mortal nature, although the words have a similar root. Mother and matrix and matter are all linguistically related. And liberate rather than liberation.
Blessed be universal what?
No, it's blessed be you mortal matter in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stanza. Mortal matter, not mortal mater. Mm. So what do you find in this that you either respond to or feel frustrated by?
For me, the fourth verse there, the second sentence, triple abyss of stars and atoms and generations. About 15, 20 years ago, I began going through a very dark time and felt that I was standing on the edge of an abyss, mm-hmm. and that everything was black and dark mm-hmm. and empty. But this is an abyss that's filled with stars and atoms and galaxies and moons and...
Yeah. It's interesting because the abyss really does mm-hmm. focus on the distances between things, which is emptiness.
And black. Well, it was black.
Right.
But this has lights in it, and movement.
Mm-hmm.
But usually an abyss, I would associate abyss with being down,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and stars are up.
Well, if you look at the three terms in that line, stars take us out into the universe and focus us on both the enormity of the size of the universe and the vast distances mm-hmm. between us and the next. Atoms take us down into the tiniest. And we know from science, we know intellectually, although I don't think we really know, that everything that appears to be solid is actually empty space.
Mm-hmm.
And then generations gives us a focus on the abyss of time. So you have the macro, the micro, and the temporal put together there. And yes, each of them contains a paradox, doesn't it? Because it contains both absence and presence. How do we know absence? We know absence only by presence, but we know presence in some senses. Know it in a deep way only by absence. What else did you respond to or knock your head up against?
I like the next two lines.
Mm-hmm.
Who by overflowing and dissolving our narrow standards mm-hmm. or measurements
mm-hmm.
reveal to us the dimension of God, or maybe hopefully reveal to us.
Yeah.
If we allow it.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is a matter of changing point of view, isn't it? Just as in the other poem, we got out of the city mm-hmm. and expanded our point of view here, it's a matter of we're getting away from our narrow standards. What's a long way? A couple of miles, mm-hmm. if you have to walk.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that you respond to or find interesting in this poem?
Well, I like the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, if I understand it, I think this is comforting. Blessed be you, mortal matter, you who one day will undertake the process of dissolution of things, and will thereby take us forcibly into that very heart, into the very heart of that which exists. It sounds comforting. Like it's there for you.
Mm-hmm. That in a sense, by dissolving matter, we move beyond matter. His relationship with matter in this poem is very strenuous. It's matter is harsh, barren, stubborn, perilous, violent, untamable, mighty, irresistible, shattering, universal, immeasurable, boundless, impenetrable, and mortal. So you get the sense of a spirit that is both attracted to and frustrated by the physical world, the material world, and that it's almost, you almost get the feeling that he's overcoming something in being able to bless matter rather than curse it. That there's almost a curse implicit in the blessing, and that he feels himself to be fighting with it all the time, wrestling with matter, because his sense which he expresses in the fifth stanza. And I think he tries to do some difficult philosophy in here, and I'm not sure how well it works. In the fifth stanza, blessed be you, impenetrable matter.
That's difficult for me to understand.
Yeah, it is difficult. And it's not clear to me that it works as poetry. It's a little abstract. It's not specific enough. You who interposed between our minds and the world of essences. So our minds correspond to the world of essences, but all we can experience is material things. So there's a sense for Chardin that there's spirit and spirit, but that matter is, it's all clothed in matter, and matter frustrates us. But that the veil of phenomena, that is to say, the material world that clouds our vision so that we can't see through to essences is seamless. Well, you know, maybe if this were a philosophy text, and maybe if you were able to make the argument, that would work. But in a piece of poetry, I think that it's much more likely that our minds are going to just sort of do like a pool, you know, a pool ball on a pool cue. They're just going to rebound and go back.
I had trouble enjoying this poem or getting any comfort from it, which was so different from that first poem.
Yes, right.
It causes you to think a lot, and it is more like philosophy. And I thought I liked him normally.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't something that I'm having, that I'm enjoying.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it causes me to think a little bit too much for today.
Yeah, well, you get the feeling that he doesn't enjoy matter either, and so he feels as though he has to bless it because...
he sounds kind of angry.
Yeah.
What a paleontologist, what are all the things that a paleontologist does?
Paleontologists study the past as the past is revealed to us in the rock record. So they'll study fossils, they'll do carbon dating, they'll look at imprints of ferns or dinosaurs or whatever, I think. Let's take a look at the next one, and we'll see how you respond to that. The next one is the Navajo chant. And I believe that the chant would have accompanied a dance, and that it would have been sung. Certainly, to have it written down is the most unfamiliar way for that culture of carrying this language, because it was an oral culture, as the Chinook was also. And this is, while I think the Chinook was more recent, I think this is a very old chant that's been translated. And in the translation, there are perhaps words that will seem a little bit unusual to you, but I'm assuming that it would have been performed, but it would have been performed by the community. It would not have been performed by a priest or a shaman or something. Everyone would have been in it, and it would have been accompanied by some manner of physical movement, some kind of dance. And it might be an interesting poem to take with you to the labyrinth, because the labyrinth gives you that feeling of physical embodiment of meditation, that meditation isn't just something that occurs in the brain, it's something that occurs in the body and it occurs in the world. For the Navajo people, language, which is of course spoken language, is an expression of spirit, and it calls into being that which it names. So language makes humans co-creators with God in the world and gives humans the obligation to continue to create the world or to co-create the world. And so the chant would have been a chant to restore harmony between the human and the physical world, within the individual human and between the humans. So the language, the ritual, the chanting, the dancing, all of them would have had the goal of the restoration of harmony, the restoration of community, the restoration of personal health. And the language is a kind of, we might use the word magical, and they might use the word magical too, but not in any suspicious sense, but it's a spiritual way of invoking. Language invokes spirit. So language, in that sense, invokes the spirits of those inanimate beings, or what we would call inanimate beings, those beings that surround us. So the chant is calling all beings into relationship. So I'll read it. I wish I could do something more musical than read, but that's the best you're going to get today. House made of dawn, house made of evening light, house made of the dark cloud, house made of male rain, house made of dark mist, house made of female rain, house made of pollen, house made of grasshoppers. Dark cloud is at the door, the trail out of it is dark cloud. The zigzag lightning stands upon it, an offering I make. Restore my feet for me, restore my legs for me, restore my body for me, restore my mind for me, restore my voice for me. This very day, take out your spell for me. Happily, I recover. Happily, my interior becomes cool. Happily, I go forth. My interior feeling cool, may I walk. No longer sore, may I walk. Impervious to pain, may I walk. With lively feelings, may I walk. As it used to be long ago, may I walk. Happily may I walk, happily with abundant dark clouds may I walk, happily with abundant showers may I walk, happily with abundant plants may I walk, happily on a trail of pollen may I walk, happily may I walk, being as it used to be long ago may I walk. May it be beautiful before me, may it be beautiful behind me, may it be beautiful below me. May it be beautiful above me. May it be beautiful all around me. In beauty it is finished. In beauty it is finished. The Navajo, of course, are southwestern people, and the rain is very important. So the dark cloud, the male rain, the female rain are all invocations to the fertility of nature to bring the rain that's necessary for the plants to grow. The pollen, of course, is the fertile factor in the life of the plants, so all of these get invoked. Abundant dark clouds, abundant showers.
Is the word house symbolic?
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is what do you understand? What's your intuitive understanding?
I was wondering if the word house is symbolic.
Oh. I mean, since we don't know how symbolizes X or Y or Z, what is the house that's being invoked here?
Is that your body?
Well, your body can be a form of a house, can't it?
Your life.
House can be an image for your life.
I think it also can be a metaphor for house or shelter, mm-hmm. or that which mm-hmm. keeps you together.
Mm-hmm. So sheltering universe,
mm-hmm.
sheltering community.
I don't understand the grasshoppers because in there.
You know, maybe they're pollinators. I don't know.
Because, you know, they're so destructive. At one time in the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
they just literally ate all of the it put clothes on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And they ate the
Yeah, that's exactly true. They just devour everything in their path. So I don't understand why that's in there.
Well, I can't give you an answer to that. It makes some sense to me to think of them as pollinators. It certainly is a house. If you think of house as the sheltering spirit, the sheltering universe, then the house contains the fertilizing rain, contains the fertile pollen, perhaps it contains the pollinator. It contains the other creatures. It's not the orca. And it maybe isn't as destructive in its own habitat, too. I mean, maybe what it did in the Midwest was because it was away from its own habitat. I just don't know. So any parts of this that you respond to, or any parts of it that you find strange?
There's a blessing that we use sometimes at when we send people forth.
Mm-hmm.
That this may it be beautiful before you,
mm-hmm.
behind you, below you, above you, which I think ours comes from St. Patrick, the prayer of St. Patrick.
Mm.
And it's very interesting that here in Native America is the same basic concept in the same words as this other one.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, of course, St. Patrick was in Ireland at a time when there were very traditional religious practices there. Yeah. I think that a lot of the words in here, just like the word house, are words that have a lot more inclusion in their meanings than the literal. So that beautiful, I assume, means also harmonious, peaceful, abundant, and not just sort of aesthetically pleasing. And happily, to me, it implies in harmony. Mm-hmm. In harmony with the universe. Because, of course, the native people believed that it was their harmony with other creatures that allowed them to succeed in the hunt. They would perform rituals before they would go on a hunt, and in the ritual they would have an enactment of the hunt, which also often involved sort of being the deer as well as being the hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And they believed that the deer people sacrificed themselves for the two-leggeds, but would not do so unless they were in right relationship, and that everything depended on relationship, which is very ecological.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem that our culture has had has been that we have been out of balance and out of relationship and not understood the way that nature requires balance and relationship. Another little thing I would point out is take out your spell for me, which relates to the belief that I was explaining earlier about the power of language, that the voice is the last thing that is asked to be restored, because the voice is your power if you're the co-creator. It's through your voice that you are able to restore harmony. I love the notion of happily my interior becomes cool. That the interior balance, the psychological health, is directly parallel to the exterior balance, the balance with nature, and the community balance.
I feel very much that this is a healing poem.
Mm-hmm.
A particular healing for me.
Mm-hmm. You know, request for healing, mm-hmm. one or the other.
Well, yeah. Request, I suppose, but it just felt very good.
Did it?
Yeah,
good.
To read it.
Yeah, I think it is a petition for healing.
No longer, you know, sore may I walk in previous pain, but feel, you know, and it's the pains of the world or
mm-hmm.
community or
mm-hmm.
self or whatever.
Physical injury.
Physical injury, right.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't the "May I walk" an interesting petition? Yeah. Because, of course, to walk is a metaphor, again, for to go, to be in the world. Mm-hmm. But it has the literal part to it as well, because this is a culture that would have walked. Mm-hmm. And whose relationship to the planet would have been one that walking induces.
Mm-hmm. And they walked everywhere.
Everywhere, right, because horses weren't
walking
introduced.
Walking was significant in those days, much more so than now.
Right, absolutely. It's one of the things I love. I was thinking this on a hike the other day, that we are still getting from one place to another in the way that human beings have always gotten from one place to another. When we're here.
The longer I'm up here, the more I realize the disparity between the simplicity of life here and the complexity of life out there. I think of it more and more as out there, the other world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last poem I've given you, which we haven't got time to talk about, but I'll just read to you, is a perfect poem to conclude with. It's by Wendell Berry, and it's from his book, Sabbaths, which I had asked the bookstore to order, but they weren't able to get, but they do have a collected poems of Wendell Berry, so it's possible that this one is in there. And you'll see that he's got in here three terms. One of them is a place which keeps the memory of paradise, and that's what I think of as Holden. And the other is the peopled dark of our unraveling century, and that's the world out there. And what Berry tries to propose is a synthesis which enables us to keep the memory of Holden. So I'll just read it to you, and you can have it and live with it for a bit. What if, in the high, restful sanctuary that keeps the memory of paradise, were followed by the drone of history, and greed's poisonous fumes still burn our eyes? Disharmony recalls us to our work. From heavenly work of light and wind and leaf, we must turn back into the peopled dark of our unraveling century, the grief of waste, the agony of haste and noise. It is a hard return from Sabbath rest to life work of the fields. Yet we rejoice returning, less condemned in being blessed by vision of what human work can make, a harmony between woodland and field. The world as it was given for love's sake, the world by love and loving work revealed as given to our children and our maker in that healed harmony, the world is used but not destroyed. The giver and the taker joined, the taker blessed in the unabused gift that nurtures and protects. Then workday and Sabbath live together in one place. Though mortal, incomplete, that harmony is our one possibility of peace. When field and woods agree, they make a rhyme that stirs in distant memory the whole first Sabbath song that no largesse of time or hope or sorrow wholly can recall. But harmony of earth is heaven made. Heaven making is promise and is prayer, a little song to keep us unafraid. And earthly music magnified in air. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
And he uses those terms of woodland and field and that harmony to bring that back.
Healed harmony.
Healed harmony, right. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you. This was great.
And I love all your comments and your additions, and I always feel like I go away from these so enriched by everyone else's observations and thoughts.
Are you doing any more things?
I am doing exactly this with different poems. Tomorrow I'm doing one on the solace of nature, where I have some poems about how we are estranged from nature, and then a couple of others about how nature offers us solace. And then I have...
You do it at the same time?
No, I think tomorrow is 3:45, and then on Saturday I have one at 6-something, that 6 o'clock hour, and that one's on the presence of death and the cycles of nature, and then next week I have two fabulous poems on snakes, And I have some terrific poems on birds. And I have more poems on consolations of nature and songs of nature. So there's a whole lot of poems.
So if I'm unable to attend tomorrow, I could still get the poems?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I'll be happy to give you copies.
Super, super. We're going home today.
Oh, you are? Oh, well, have a lovely trip out. And let Wendell Berry offer you some company.
You can't go to everything.
They didn't
need
you
in the industry. No, it's really a quiet day. There's not a whole lot to do.
And you know, Esther, I will leave all the extra poems that I have here at the village before I go. So that
I can see some of these in winter vespers.
Oh, I can see lots of these in vespers,
Well, sometimes you have to read a poem quite a number of times.
That's right.
That's right. And the groove of it.
Again, that's why I think reading in community is so wonderful, because it saves you some of that, because other people know this thing.
Do you write your own poetry?
I do some. I haven't written poetry for a couple of years, or a year and a half anyway, because I've been working on this book. But I have to go do dish.
Oh,
I have dish duty, but I'll be happy to talk to you endlessly,
bore you to tears about my book.
Oh, I'd love to hear about your book.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wish I could have gone on that other. I think that would have been very interesting. The one where it was at least 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, that she did with Laurel Ross, I think. She said it was a long time, probably a little bit too long, but she said it was interesting. So you're going back today. Have you been here for a while?
Monday.
No. It was too short.
Monday, that's all we can.
You have, haven't you, Judy? Years ago.
There's something healing about the
about being here. And you know it's here that you can come back to it.
Right.
It's pretty handy for us. Yes, you don't have.
I'm going to stay in the reading room for me.
What?
I'm going to stay in the reading room.
Oh, good idea. Where it's cool, huh? Although it has gotten a little.
It's nice in there.
Yeah. I like that room. Maybe call it a fever.
I don't know if. I think that's all. We can't go to anything else because there isn't any more time.